Episode 1132, The Transfiguration and Other Bible Thoughts.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Van DiBono.
And we're back, and listeners, a few weeks back, we released the Rosary episode.
That's getting great reviews.
Yeah, we first released it on the Patreon feed, which you can find at patreon.com/thesci-fi-christian. But then, something we do rarely, we brought it over to the main feed because what Ben shared was worth sharing with everybody. I guess lots of what we do is worth sharing with everybody. This one felt more like we should share it with everybody.
I'm glad we did.
In the midst of the Rosary episode, Ben commented on the Transfiguration and didn't dive in.
Yes, we're going to talk a little bit about that. It's a little bit off the cuff. Yeah. So maybe if there's still more to say, we can do a Transfiguration deep dive sometime.
Yeah, it just seemed like you thought what people think about the Transfiguration isn't really what's happening there.
Yeah.
But you didn't go any deeper, and I'm interested in hearing more of your thoughts.
And then along the way with that, I've actually reading... So Pope Benedict XVI has published a trilogy of books on Jesus. I actually read his first one before I was even Catholic, which is on the life of Jesus. The third one is on the infancy narratives. And then the one that I'm reading right now is on Passion Week. And so, you know, Pope Benedict XVI, whether you're Catholic or Protestant, just one of the great theological thinkers of the 20th and early 21st century. And so there's a couple of things from that I... You know, they're not long enough to fill a full episode, but especially as people are listening to this potentially in Holy Week, I thought might be interesting things to share. So,
yeah, that sounds good. So, tell me your thoughts on the Transfiguration. What have I been getting wrong?
Well, tell me your thoughts.
Yes.
I'll turn the tables back on you.
No, I think that's
because I do like to start. I feel like you do a good job of kind of expressing a level set for us. Of maybe where people are at on a given story.
I think this is a good place to start because I'll admit that even though I've read the story multiple times and I can tell you like visually what I think is happening, I don't know the meaning behind it. So visually we have Jesus up on the mountain.
Yeah, he goes to Mount Tabor.
With his three close disciples.
Peter, James, and John.
And we've got a surprise appearance from the past, all the way from the past.
Blast from the past.
Don't tell. Is it Moses and Elijah?
It is.
They just pop up out of nowhere. And the interesting thing about this is I think it's Peter who recognizes them. He knows who they are somehow.
Well, and I don't know if it's clear if Peter knows who they are. Peter's scared out of his mind. Like, that's in the text.
I could be wrong. I don't have the text in front of me because, like Ben said, we're doing this a little bit off the cuff. But I feel like one of the disciples was able to identify.
Well, obviously somebody figured it out.
Yeah.
You know, because it's in the book.
But if we're just looking at Jesus, we get the sense that he's...
But you're leaving a really important part of the story out, which is why it's called the Transfiguration.
Well, let me say everything and then you add in what I'm forgetting.
Okay.
He's glowing in a supernatural way.
There you go.
That's what I'm trying to get
to. Do you want me just to read?
Is that what you thought I was going to forget?
Yeah.
The Transfiguration? So he's glowing, and it's cool, but now I'll admit, and the reason I wanted to do this episode and talk to you more about it is, I don't exactly know what that symbolizes or what are we learning. We're already going into the story believing that Jesus is God, especially us, reading it here in the future.
Yeah.
We already know Jesus is God. So what did it mean to them at the time? Was this one of their big signs? I feel like by this point, Peter had already identified him as the Christ. So, yes, tell me what's happening here. What's the meaning? Why does this happen?
Yeah, so let me just read this from Matthew 17. It says, "After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, 'Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah.'"
There it is, identifying them.
Yeah, so you're right. Peter figures it out. "While he was still speaking," maybe they had name tags on.
Yeah, that's
"Hello,
puzzles. My name is."
He was still speaking. A bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down on the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. As they came down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead."
Pause for a second. I know you want to keep reading, but since we're going to do the deep dive dissection of this, I see a parallel to the baptism, to Jesus's baptism. But I'm also thinking, yep, Moses represents the law, potentially, and Elijah, would he represent the prophets? I don't know.
Yeah, law and the prophets.
Okay.
I think you're right.
All
right,
keep going.
So, you know, it shows up in all the synoptic gospels. So we have the same, very similar from Mark. And then let me just pull up, you know, Luke's version and see if he's got anything.
Is Elijah typically the stand-in for the prophets? Like, Moses is obviously the stand-in for the law.
I don't know. That's a good question. So Luke does have some slightly different details here. This is NIV because that's what Wikipedia linked to. So it says, they spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment in Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but then when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. So that'd be one detail I'm going to seize on in a
bit. So they were all three glowing, not just Jesus? Is that what you mean?
Well, no, that Peter and the others become sleepy and then they wake up and see this.
Oh,
but
no.
I do think that...
You think they're dreaming?
Yeah, exactly. It's a David Lynch section of the Gospels. Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. Mm-hmm. Well, he was speaking, and then a voice comes and says the same thing. So we get a number of things in here. One is that Peter's kind of grasping at straws. He's like, "I don't know what is happening. Maybe we should build a house." Like, that's kind of the impression you get of Peter. And then you also get sort of this messianic secret of Jesus saying, "Don't tell anyone about this until later." So as you, it's a fascinating story. It's a really fascinating story because it is sort of taking the veil off of, you know, Jesus revealing his glory in a way that I don't think he really does elsewise on earth. I mean, certainly you have the resurrection and you have miracles associated with that. You have the ascension, but not with this sort of unveiled transfiguration type experience.
It is reminding me of when Moses was walking on the mountain.
Very much
and had
so.
To have his eyes covered. Like, the impression, and I could be wrong, again, we don't have the story in front of us, but the impression I get is that God at that point was also maybe too bright for Moses.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the whole idea. They put a veil on Moses.
Was it just that he couldn't look upon him, or was it that he couldn't look on him because he was so glowing?
In the Moses story, we're jumping around a little bit, but we're jumping around to places I wanted to hit on with this. So in the Moses story in Zion, what happens is Moses asks God to see his face, and God says, "If you see my face, you're going to die. So, but you can see my back." And so God passes in front of Moses. Moses is able to kind of peek out through his fingers. And then he comes down the mountain and Mount Sinai. And then the people see him and they have to put a veil over his face because nobody can look at Moses.
Because he's glowing.
He's glowing. Moses is reflecting God's glory there.
Right. You know, this is really interesting that I love just tearing this up apart because we're like, diving in a way that I haven't done about this story. Elijah, we know that he ascends to heaven without dying. But another thing about Elijah is that John the Baptist is continually compared to Elijah. There's some connection there. Some people even thought when they were trying to guess who Jesus might be, they thought maybe Jesus was Elijah because there was this prophecy of Elijah making a return.
Right.
So again, John is a parallel. John the Baptist is a parallel. But also, is this the return that was prophesied?
I don't necessarily want to venture an opinion on that because I don't know what I haven't done a lot of reading on that, but we could say it's a reasonable opinion to have. I'd be comfortable saying that. I think the other interpretation of that would be that John is the returned Elijah, not in the sense of being reincarnated, but as in fulfilling that same type of role.
Like a voice in the wilderness.
Exactly. Yep. But I think the key thing is, so if we start, we've got a number of different data points here, and I think you're starting to hit on what I find so fascinating about the Transfiguration, is that it sort of is this nexus of connection to other areas in both the Gospels and in the Old Testament. Obviously, Moses and Elijah being the obvious one. But more than that, if you look at mountains in the Old Testament, they play a very pivotal role. You know, you have Mount Sinai, where Moses goes up and gets the law, where he sees Jesus, or not sees Jesus, sees God and has God's glory. Elijah has a mountaintop experience when he hears the small voice of God, you know, when he's basically throwing a fit, wanting to die and everything. You also have Mount Moriah with the sacrifice of Isaac in there, and the substitution of the ram in its place. And so you kind of have this through line in the Old Testament of mountaintop experiences as being places where God and humanity meet in a very critical way. And so then you have the same thing taking place at the Transfiguration. Then in the life of Christ, the parallel, and you're absolutely correct about the baptism. I don't want to undersell that one. But I think that one people do pick up on, in that, yes, there's a parallel to this with the voice from heaven, just like the voice from heaven speaks at Jesus's baptism. The voice from heaven also speaks here. But there's another parallel that I think is really, really fascinating, and I don't see spoken about very much when it comes to the Transfiguration, which is the agony in the garden. The Transfiguration parallels the Garden of Gethsemane perfectly.
Tell me more.
So in the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter, James, and John also come along with Jesus there. They also fall asleep. They also don't have any clue what to do when they wake up. And it's also the moment of Jesus unveiling his glory to the disciples. So what I want to stress here, I want to say something, which is that I want to remind us all that the Gospels are theological narratives. So just to clear up anybody being concerned about what I'm saying, I 100% believe in the Transfiguration as a historical event that actually happened, okay? I also think that part of what you have happening in the writing of the Gospels is the reinterpretation of historical events, be it the Transfiguration, be it the miracles, be it the preaching of Jesus, be it all of those different things, within the context of, among a few other things, the death and resurrection of Jesus. Okay, so part of what's going on in the writing of the Gospels is you have the Gospel writers, the early church has experienced, the very early church, the primitive church, has experienced the death and resurrection of Jesus, and now they're going back through the life of Jesus, and they are highlighting elements of the life of Christ with an eye of saying something of worth about the resurrection of Christ. In other words, what we have in the Gospels is not just a random assortment of bibliographical data, or biographical data, rather. They're not meant to just be like, oh yeah, we should put in that story. It's not like telling somebody about your vacation, and it's just, these were the highlights. Because John himself in his gospel tells us there were more things than could be written down. So what you have in terms of what is actually written down are items that are chosen for a deliberate purpose, okay? And then those details of them are written in such a way to highlight the theological truth. They're not being written, even though they are historical events. The miracles, the Transfiguration, all of that are historical events. They are written without an eye to history. Their primary purpose is theology. Okay, so it's big idea here, but I think it's important to a proper understanding of the Gospels. That's also why you have differing chronologies between the Synoptics and the Gospel of John, where the Gospel of John seems to take place over a three-year period. The Synoptics reduce the life of Christ to a one-year period. You have things like the overthrowing of the money changers in the temple taking place during Passion Week, and the Gospel of John taking place in outside of Passion Week in the Synoptics. If you come away and notice those discrepancies and your first reaction is, well, which one was it? I'm going to say you're asking the wrong question, not because that wasn't a historical event. I believe it was, but because it doesn't matter. The point of the Gospels in retelling that event is not to say it happened this time, and then John's like, oh, no, it actually happened now. It's both of them are using it for greater theological ends. Same thing with the Transfiguration. So with the Transfiguration, there's this incredible experience that the disciples have no context to be able to explain, and then why do they explain it now? Well, they explain it in the Gospels. It's highlighted in the Synoptics as evidence of Jesus's divinity, because that's part of what the Gospel writers are interested in communicating. It's easy for us to remember that, yes, Jesus throughout the Gospels and throughout his life does declare himself as divine, but he sort of gets around to it. Like day one, when Jesus shows up and he's recruiting the disciples, they don't have any reason to assume that he's divine. Like, so this is, at least this is the sense we get from the narrative, this is a gradual thing that is coming on as the life of Christ is continuing. Like, at first, this guy's a good teacher, he's a rabbi, oh, he's a prophet, oh, he's the Messiah, but even the idea of the Messiah being divine isn't a given. Like, that's not something that you would have assumed, even if you say he is the Messiah. And so the idea that Jesus is divine as a creed of the early church, and indeed a creed that's arrived at prior to his death and resurrection, like, we take that as a given. You open up to Matthew 1:1, and you already assume Jesus is the Son of God. Like, that's a point of contention that the Gospel writers are arguing for.
I think I hear you saying that they knew a Messiah or somebody that was going to save the people was coming, but to them it's just a human that's going to come and lead the way. They weren't expecting that human to also be God.
Yeah, 100%. If you read Messianic prophecy and you read extra biblical literature about, you know, Second Temple Judaism's beliefs in a Messiah, there's no reason you would come to the conclusion that the Messiah will be God. Like, that's a development of that doctrine that takes place within Christianity. And so even the presence of the resurrection doesn't necessarily prove that if you were to take it in isolation, right? So the early church is at pains to argue for the fact of Jesus's divinity. And indeed, we would say that's not even entirely cleared up in the early church until the Council of Nicaea. You know, the defeat of the Arians. It's the majority view, but it's not formally adopted until a number of centuries later. But anyway, we're getting a little far afield from the point of the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration is arguing for the divinity of Christ, and it's arguing for the divinity of Christ centered on the Passion narrative. I think that's the key thing. So it simultaneously is looking back to other encounters of God and man with its mountaintop thing, with its, Moses-esque echoes. But it's also like, let's pause on the Moses thing for a second, because we've highlighted the idea that Moses sees the back of God and he is sort of he gets like a diet transfiguration there on Mount Sinai. But what we see in the Transfiguration is that Moses and Elijah both talk to God on the mountaintop, and Jesus is exalted above them. He's an order of magnitude greater than Moses and greater than Elijah. So we're arguing for this being a comparison to previous mountaintop experiences, literal mountaintop experiences of communion with the divine, but we're also arguing for it being of a greater type than it is the next step up. There is something different about this. And even more than that, then, we're going to continue this narrative. We're going to connect the narrative forward to the Mount of Olives, the agony in the garden, connecting it to the passion of Christ, which brings us full circle back to the Mount Moriah sacrifice of Isaac. So all of this becomes woven together with the transfiguration as the hub of it, that this is the argument for the divinity of Christ and for the importance of Christ as the fulfillment of what all these other moments were looking forward to.
I like it. Yeah, so when you said people don't even know exactly what's happening there, you were saying they know the basics, but they are not seeing the whole picture, all the pieces.
It's a problem with how we read the Bible, right? Because unfortunately, like the same mind virus that had infected liberal Christianity in the 19th century also infected conservative Christianity. They just, like, the way that a fundamentalist reads the Bible is the same way Richard Dawkins reads the Bible, and they both miss everything it's actually trying to say. Read it as this wooden narrative of, like, well, then this happened. It's like, dear diary, today I went up to the Mount Tabor and Jesus got a little bright. Okay, next story. Like, no. Like, this story is chosen to actually make a theological point. It's chosen to connect these different things. You know, it's the same thing that's going on in a lot of Paul's letters. Like, he's importing narratives about, you know, Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant and everything. And so you can't just read this as you would a documentary. It's not a documentary, even though it's telling you historical events. I think this is like, and I've made this point probably unsuccessfully, but I've also been developing it for a number of years on the show, of like that, you know, you can't read the Gospels as history. Well, does that mean you think they didn't happen? No. But it means they're not written as history. It's like taking real events and remixing them. Like, a great example of this, and I do want to get to a couple of the points from the Benedict book in a second, but just to maybe go on this tangent for a moment, like, the Gospel of Mark is really, really fascinating because Mark is simultaneously a history of the life of Christ and a history of the early church. Like, because what we see at the beginning of Mark, like right in the first chapter, is that, you know, Jesus heals. He goes into Capernaum and he heals Peter's mother-in-law, and then he and his disciples gather for a meal. So, like, well, what's that about? You know, is Mark just trying to tell us that they had a meal? Well, if we're reading this in the stupid way, then yes. But if we're actually reading this with theological eyes, like, oh, the early church talking about a meal, that feels a little Eucharistic, right? So now this is talking about that the miracle of Christ leads to the ritual meal of the Eucharist. Like, that's what's happening in that narrative of Mark. So if we're asking what was on the menu that day, we're asking the dumbest possible question, not because Jesus didn't historically eat, and not because he in all probability, you know, didn't have a meal with Peter and his mother-in-law at some point, but that's like the least interesting part of that story. Is it like, who cares? Who cares? And I get that there's other narratives that have greater weight to whether or not they quote unquote actually happen than that one. But I'm just using it as an example that whatever Mark is doing in that moment, and you can agree or disagree with my argument that he's talking about the Eucharistic experience in the early church. Clearly I'm coming at that with a Catholic lens, but one I don't know of a better interpretation for it, but clearly whatever else Mark is doing, this man who is writing with an economy of language, who has by far the shortest gospel, is not interested in telling us about Jesus's gastronomical experience. That's not what's happening there. Whatever it is, it's not that. So that's my point when it comes to how to read the Gospels. When I talk about them being a theological narrative, it doesn't mean that what's happening isn't historical. It does mean that the historiness of whatever is happening is oftentimes the least interesting part about it. So hopefully that makes sense to people.
All right.
But a couple interesting thoughts from Pope Benedict. One of which on Judas, and then one, and this might even be something that will springboard into another one of these, on the washing of the feet narrative in John's Gospel, which is really fascinating. Another one where I can make an aside statement that people don't really understand what's happening in that narrative. I'll try and unpack that a little bit more for tonight. But the interesting point Benedict made, and it kind of ties back to our universalism episode where we got on that whole topic by talking about Judas and the to the extent that Judas was damned and is in hell. And let's just say that that's more probable than not, even though I stand by my earlier statement that I'm unwilling to say with 100% certainty that anybody is or is not. Well, we can say a few that are not in hell, but you get the point from that.
Yeah, because you said during that episode, it's a sin.
Like, yes.
In Catholicism, it's a sin to presume one way or another about someone when you don't know anything.
Yeah, Augustine put it really well. He said, two thieves were crucified with Christ. One of them was saved. Do not despair. One of them was damned. Do not presume. It's like both of those are sins.
Mm-hmm.
To assume that you are saved. Full stop. You can know you're in a state of grace as a Catholic. That's a different ballgame. But to assume that you're going to heaven, full stop. It's a sin.
So in Catholicism, you're saying it's a sin. If I was a Catholic, it would be a sin for me to assume I'm going to heaven.
Yeah. Just full stop.
But when
100%.
You say I can be in a state of grace, that means I'm just going to try to say, and you can fix it, that I can trust that Jesus's sacrifice covers over me so I can get to heaven.
Yes.
But I can't say I am going to heaven. I guess maybe the distinction's a little tough for me to see.
You can fall out of a state of grace.
Okay.
You know, and you don't have a guarantee of God's mercy. God's mercy is a gift given to us. We don't get to presume on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gift given to us, even when we're in a state of grace. It's a gift. By the same token, though, like that doesn't be like, if you go to the other extreme, be like, well, God's mercy is a gift, and you better watch out because he can yank that gift at any time.
It sounds like that. Like, I don't usually push you too hard on the differences between Catholicism and Protestantism, but it does sound to me initially, and maybe I just don't fully understand it, that if you're saying the gift of grace, like, keeps getting taken away. Is that what you, is
no,
that
what
it's
not
like
what I'm
in Catholicism?
If you commit a mortal sin, you're out of a state of grace.
What if you just do a regular sin, but you haven't done your confession?
If you've a venial sin does not take you out of a state of grace, a mortal sin does.
Okay, mortal sins, like, you're done for at that point, or I don't know what happens with the different levels of sins. Can you get a mortal sin forgiven?
Of course.
Okay, so there's no sin that's too far in Catholicism.
100%.
Even I've heard some people say there are sins that are like too far. Like, for example, I think we've talked about on the show. I think at some point some people believe that suicide, like, that would automatically go to hell. But I think I've heard you say that's not true.
Well, so one of the things about mortal sin is that it requires the full consent. You have to fully consent to mortal sin. So things that would be a mortal sin, like taking your own life.
Or anyone's life.
Life. Are mitigated by the fact that they're, you know, you're mentally ill at that point. I mean, suicide, obviously a very heavy topic is, and I say this hopefully with the hope of giving, you know, reassuring people who maybe have had friends or family members who have undergone
that. I mean, I've told you, I've had a family member who died by suicide. So yeah, I do. This topic is personal to me.
Yeah, and it is to a lot of people. And I, yes, suicide is the destruction of an innocent life. Murder is a sin, you know, is a mortal sin. But somebody committing suicide is dealing with things that the rest of us can't imagine, and it's a perfect example of this, you know, trusting in God's grace. Like, should we presume on it that, oh, of course, somebody who commits suicide, of course they're in because, you know, they were dealing with mental health issues. Like, well, no, I'm not going to say that. But I do think people can have confidence in God's grace, that God understands what's going on.
I think I hear you saying it's not an automatic because there are other variables that God knows that we can't just look at and know.
So the conditions for mortal sin, I actually want to Google this here because I want to get this right.
Because this is my understanding of Catholicism. Mortal sins means...
it severs your relationship with God.
And you have to confess it to build the bridge back.
Yeah.
And so the reason some people may think that suicide would be a deal breaker is because once you're dead, you can't confess it, right?
Correct.
Okay. But you're saying, and so, I like what you're saying here, that if somebody is mentally unhealthy they're not thinking in the way that would be typically clear for them, like that potentially, we can't guess, but you're saying potentially God would have mercy on that.
Of course. So mortal sin is defined as a sin that severs your relationship with God and needs to be restored through the sacrament of confession. Okay? That would be the Catholic definition of mortal sin. To get back into a state of grace after committing a mortal sin, you must be absolved in the sacrament of confession and perform penance. Okay? Requires three things. Number one, it has to involve grave matter. Murder. Number two, you have to have full knowledge of what you're doing. You know, so like if it's a dumb example, but you have a button on your desk and you pushed it, you've been pushing it every day just for fun because you like the way that button feels. And then one fine day you realize that button was killing somebody every time. You probably would want to go and, you know, if you're a Catholic, go and confess that. But is that a mortal sin? No, you had no clue what you were doing. You had no clue. The next time you push the button, it's a different story, mm-hmm. but you don't have that full knowledge. And then this is the key one when it comes to something like suicide or addictions or stuff like that, is deliberate consent. You have to be in a place where you can consent. Like, you are choosing this sin deliberately. Mm-hmm. And I think in the case of most suicides, it's hard to imagine that third one taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
yeah, I mean it did get heavy, but yeah, I think it's important. I think that was a good conversation to have. In Protestantism, I think it's totally different picture, right? It's more.
It depends. Like
I feel like there's because we don't have the exact same things when it comes to levels of sin or confession. I think people in Protestantism would believe that somebody could sin, like commit suicide, but still be in a state of salvation. Right?
Yeah, yes. I don't know why Protestants don't believe in mortal sin. And I'm going to tell you exactly what I mean. Then I promise we'll get back to Judas in just a second. But, you know, this is directly from 1 John 5. If anyone sees his, and I'm just reading this off a website, I don't know what translation this is. If anyone sees his brother committing a sin not leading to death, he shall ask and God will give him life. To those who commit sins that do not lead to death. There is sin that leads to death. I do not say that one should pray for that. All wrongdoing is sin, but there is sin that does not lead to death. So
it doesn't say what exact sin does, exactly. But you're saying in Catholicism you lay it out more clearly.
As Catholics, we would say the doctrine of mortal versus venial sin develops from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how, I don't know any possible interpretation of that verse where you come away and say all sin exactly the same. Because
mm-hmm.
clearly that's not what that verse says.
So that verse you think is saying there is a sin that leads to hell. Like when you can use death interchangeably as.
At the very minimum, yes. John is saying there is sin that doesn't lead to death and there is sin that does. There are two different levels of sin.
And you're saying hell, death that does, or there is sin that does not lead to hell and sin that does lead to hell, automatically is the implication.
Yes.
Okay.
You can probably find nuanced interpretations that would fit with that verse, but I don't know of any interpretation that would land with a wholesale rejection of mortal and venial sin. A Protestant theology could maybe call them other things or develop other nuances on them, but I don't know of any valid theology that can deal with that verse and not come away with something like, not exactly, but like the Catholic belief in mortal and venial sin. Okay, so back to Judas.
Did you ever explain? I just can't remember because we've talked about so many things in this episode. When I was saying I didn't see the distinction between under grace and... saved, I think it was. Remember I was saying I didn't exactly...
being in a state of grace versus going to heaven?
Yeah.
Here's the for which one you can presume on.
So, well, not even presume on. Like you're saying, I can't know for sure I'm going. This is you talking.
Yes.
As a Catholic, I can't know for sure I'm going to heaven, but I can know I'm under a state of grace.
Yes.
So I don't think I understand the difference there, because state of grace seems to indicate that person would go to heaven.
You can lose a state of grace.
Okay.
And even within the state of grace.
So if you are under the state of grace, then you know that you're going to heaven, right? Like you as a Catholic?
But even there, here's the distinction, and it's a slight distinction, but I still would want to make this. Even under a state of grace, I am dependent on the mercy of God, which I have no right to. Okay? There's still a perspective that's important. As a Catholic in a state of grace, I believe that if I died, I'm going to heaven.
I think I know the answer to this question, but do you believe that Protestants presume too much about their own salvation?
It depends. I think five-point Calvinists who would say that they have perseverance of the saints.
Or like where you can't lose your salvation.
Yeah, I completely reject that view. Okay. That view is not compatible with Catholicism.
But if somebody like me, just believing that the grace covers me, and of course, I try not to sin, but I will fall into sin, don't necessarily have an exact confession system. You know, like,
yeah.
I guess I'll just leave it there. Like, I don't necessarily, of course, I can ask for forgiveness, but not necessarily like a systematic way. So, do you think that somebody like me presumes too much about my own salvation? Like,
not necessarily.
Do I count on God's grace too much?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's possible, but it's also possible for a Catholic who goes to confession to if a Catholic was going to confession, be like, well, just got to go drop these sins off and then back to life. Like, obviously, that's presuming on grace too. So I think that Protestants, by and large, not all, but many Protestants have an underdeveloped theology of confession.
Yes, I would say that for myself. Like, I definitely ask for forgiveness, but I don't have a systematic way of, like, I wouldn't say I go through all of my sins.
And yeah, see, and I'm not even assuming that you would confess to a priest or your pastor or somebody like that under that.
No, just in my prayer.
Exactly. I think.
But you think that's okay, right? Like, well, no, not for not for Catholics. So
well,
you don't,
not for you either.
You don't think I could just, like, who would I confess to? Like, in a Protestantism, I confess to God and say, I mean, well, it's not even a confession. He knows what's up. So I just, I ask for forgiveness.
If I was to articulate what I would consider to be.
You know, it's not even a confession. I'm just realizing. I'm not really confessing anything.
Yeah.
Because I'm talking to God. He knows. I'm more just acknowledging my sin and asking for forgiveness. But I don't know if I would say I'm confessing, because confessing feels like revealing.
I would encourage Protestants, and there are a few flavors of Protestants that have confession, but say Protestants who aren't going to confess to anybody but God, which, you know, that's a different discussion. Look up an examination of conscience. There's tons of them out there. You know, a lot of them are Catholic. Not all of them are. And it's just going to, I think it would be a good spiritual exercise for Protestants to engage in.
So we can drop it after this question. So you know me. Who would you say, like, with what, under what I believe?
If I believed what you'd believe, yeah, I'd just confess to God. But what I'm saying is, even within that confession to God, I do think if I was developing a Protestant doctrine of confession that didn't involve confessing to a priest or pastor, I would want to add in two things. Number one, an examination of conscience. Number two, the deliberate naming of your sins in prayer to God.
Hmm.
Not because God doesn't know them, but like you can play the God already knows it game with anything. You want to pull on that thread long enough, why pray in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
God already knows it. Why does God ask you to ask him for things?
I mean, people would say that's what builds the relationship.
That's what builds the relationship.
Yeah.
It's like if I punch you in the face and come back, like, I'm sorry. What are you sorry for? Oh, you already know. that's what I mean by underdeveloped.
I'm not even
arguing the confession to another person thing. I'm just saying, like, that there's some things that maybe haven't been thought through enough.
Well, it's interesting. I like it. I like the conversation.
I do, too. Back to Judas.
Let's go back to Judas.
Okay.
Who was recently featured in one of my children's drawings of some, like, Jesus and some people from the Easter story.
That's fantastic.
And I know it was Judas because she wrote the names of the people above their heads, and Judas made it into a pitcher.
That's great.
Right here in my very own home.
So Judas, for people who know the story, of course, and I think we all do, Judas betrays Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. He meets him in the garden with the Roman soldiers. He kisses him and betrays him. And then the rest of Judas' story, I think, is known, but not maybe quite as well known. Are you aware of what happens with Judas after that fact?
He tries to return the money.
He tries to return the
money.
And they're
like, no, but we will buy a field with it.
No take backs.
Yeah. So he throws the money at them because they won't take it. So they're like, well, let's buy a field.
Yes.
And then is it in that field that he hangs himself? Or I know he goes and kills himself.
I don't think it's in the field, but he does go and kill himself.
Yeah, so he goes and kills himself from there. And that brings Judas' story to an end.
Rough night. This is not a good night for Judas. You thought Jesus had it bad.
I mean, at the end, he's like, I made a mistake.
I think you're getting to the point. If Judas is in hell, why is he in hell?
Because you're saying he realized he made an error.
Yep.
And he tried to repent.
He tried to repent and he despaired of God's grace. It's the same point we were just talking about that Benedict makes. It's really, really a powerful perspective.
And when you say despaired of God's grace, you're saying he assumed he wasn't saved?
He assumed he wasn't able to be saved.
Okay.
Right?
But like, he didn't know.
He didn't know.
But does that make him out? If he assumes he can't be saved, is he out?
Again, I'm saying probably, but like we think of Judas is in hell because he betrayed Christ. Not exactly. Judas is in hell because he didn't believe in God's forgiveness. That's a very different take on the tragedy. Now, forgiveness for what? Yes, it does come back, of course, to the betrayal of Christ. But Judas could have been saved.
Man, can you imagine that story in Acts? If
right.
he asked for forgiveness, they would right. have forgiven him, I think.
That's the point. Like, I've never considered that perspective on the story until I was reading Benedict's book, and he's absolutely right. Like, Judas, he was right there. He recognized he had done wrong. He was trying to put it right, but he never repents to God.
Oh.
He never asked. And then he takes his own life.
Well, we think. I mean,
The act of taking his own life indicates, in this case, a belief in his sin is unforgivable. That's a really powerful perspective on it.
Hmm.
Okay, so that's one little Bible tidbit. The second one, washing of the feet, maybe we'll do a more... The washing of the feet, I'll throw a couple of things out here on it, but it probably, like the whole upper room discourse in John is astonishing. The washing of the feet is really interesting because in John's gospel, it is situated at the Last Supper, and it is situated in the same place that the Eucharistic meal takes place in all of the Last Supper and all the other synoptics. So where the synoptics talk about Christ breaking the bread and serving the wine as his body and blood and instituting the Eucharist, John puts the washing of the feet. Now you think, aha, Catholics, there you go. John doesn't believe in the Eucharist. Well, not exactly, because in the Gospel of John, we also have the body and blood discourse. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood will have eternal life, and then everybody gets upset and leaves. And so John is like much more explicitly Eucharistic than even the synoptics in terms of the Eucharist being the literal body and blood of Christ. But the washing the feet is really, really interesting. Because we have a couple of things going on, but I think the one I want to highlight for this conversation that Benedict drew my attention to, and I've never considered it this way, and fair warning, this is going to be a very Catholic interpretation of the washing of the feet, is that when the washing of the feet takes place, we have a couple of things. We have A, Jesus doing it. B, he has the instruction for them to wash each other's feet. It's something that they should be doing. And then C, Peter wants to jump into the whole bath, and Jesus is like, no, you don't need the whole bath. You just need your feet washed. What is going on there?
Was he treating it like a baptism? Like was when Peter wanted to jump all the way in?
He was. Why? And let's look at this with the narrative of theology.
You're saying this is a baptism?
No, actually the opposite. I'm saying that Peter wanted to treat it like a baptism. Jesus is saying this is something else. The point Benedict makes, and this is looking at the narrative with the lens of a theological narrative. Like if just like we saw at the eating of the meal in Peter's mother-in-law, we're not interested in saying, what did Jesus have for lunch today? We're not interested in saying, well, Peter was like, well, you know, you started on the feet, might as well finish the rest of it. He's not asking for a bath. In other words, that's not what's happening. Something else is going on here. But you're right. There's a tie to baptism. Peter's saying, let's have baptism. Jesus is saying, no, this is something else. There's a direct tie between the sacrament of baptism, which washes all of you, which sets you free from original sin, and the sacrament of confession, represented in the foot washing. Foot washing, if we look at it as a symbol of a sacrament of confession, I said this was going to be a very Catholic interpretation, what we see is that you're already clean, but we need to clean this part up. It isn't a redoing of baptism. It isn't a redoing of that original being set free of original sin. It is instead returning you to a state of cleanliness as you existed after your baptism. Similarly, the other thing that we have going on in this moment of the foot washing narrative is the institution of the priesthood and of the priesthood as confessors. So if we see in this moment, and the idea of the Last Supper being the institution of the priesthood is a much bigger argument than this. But if we see in the washing of the feet a symbol of confession, then suddenly we do start to get, among a few other places in Scripture, this priestly element in there. Why do we, as Catholics, confess to a priest? Because Jesus is good enough for me. That's not the point. The point is that Jesus gives this sacrament to his apostles, to his priests, and then they go out and give it to each other, to the rest of the church. So we see in the foot washing a picture of the sacrament of confession. It's instituted by Christ.
I don't think I totally see it.
Fair enough.
I think I'll re-listen to this episode, and maybe we should follow up.
We can follow up.
But we've been having such a good conversation on confession that could... Maybe we should just do more later.
Yeah. Do you not follow or you're not convinced? Because those are two different
things. Yes, I'm not following.
Jesus, I'll try and make it clearer here. So Peter wants to be washed all over. That's what we would say the sacrament of baptism does. So let's just go with me for the sake of argument, whether or not you find the argument convincing. Go with me to say that the washing is a metaphor or a picture of the washing of sin.
Okay. So when he's washing the feet, it's as if he's washing the sin.
Yes.
Okay.
He doesn't have to wash all of them.
Okay.
They already have been washed, but their feet are dirty.
You said they've already been baptized.
They've already been baptized, but their feet are dirty.
Okay.
They need a little touching up.
Okay.
Okay. So that's exactly what the sacrament of confession is in relation to baptism.
You have grace.
You have grace, but you need to be restored. You need that cleanliness. The sin post-baptism, it doesn't undo your baptism, but it does put you in, it's like getting a little dirt on your feet. And the sacrament of confession washes that off. With me so far?
Okay, I've got you this time.
Okay, so then when Jesus takes that sacrament, so people can find this argument convincing or not, but I want to just make sure you follow it.
Yeah.
Okay, so then Jesus says to the disciples, do this to one another.
So you have, I hear what you're saying now. You're saying you have to believe that at minimum, the feet washing is a sign of confession.
Mm-hmm.
To be able then to say the second part, which is you're now empowered to go out and receive confession from others.
Yes, exactly. The institution of the priesthood.
It's interesting, but I don't think there's a straight line there, but it's interesting.
There's a straight line if you accept the premise of it being a sacrament of confession. I don't think it says the only interpretation.
Because they're not actually confessing anything. It's symbolic. So you have to. I think it's interesting, and I like this conversation. I just don't know if Like, they're not actually confessing anything. They're just being washed. It's all symbolic.
It's symbolic. 100% correct. The things that you, to give a wholesale theology of confession, I wouldn't, even from just a purely biblical standpoint, I wouldn't leave it there. Of course, there's the verse that instructs us to confess our sins to one another, which is a very interesting one if we only are supposed to confess them to God. Mm-hmm. There's other aspects of that theology in there. I say if we started to go extra biblical, I would point to the presence of confession in Second Temple Judaism as well as in the early church. That certainly this practice, this sacrament develops from the primitive church, but is very much present there. So it's not, you know, I'm not going to convince anybody to a Catholic doctrine of confession based on the washing of the feet alone. What I do want to argue, though, is that if we're going to look at the Gospels as theological narratives, we should look for things like that. And part of my argument is, whether people agree or disagree on any particular case, but that once you start understanding the Gospels as theological narrative, the sacramental, I won't say Catholic, because I want to be a little bigger tent than that, but the sacramental interpretation becomes overwhelming.
Sacramental in the terms of this is something that it gives you grace.
You cannot read the Gospels as theological narrative and not be blown away by the number of references to the Eucharist, to confession.
You're saying that the Gospels are almost a systematic theology text?
I don't like the idea of systematic theology, so no, but yes.
Or there's other kinds of
theology. I understand the point you're making.
There's other kinds of theology. Is there a kind of theology that you would say the Gospels represent?
Narrative theology. Yes.
Biblical kind of is like the whole story. But,
right.
I don't know.
I understand the point you're making.
Yeah.
And I'd say that in the sense that I think you mean it, I agree. I'm just a little allergic to the term systematic theology.
Systematic kind of implies take these steps to get to your goal.
Exactly. Systematic, to put it in the Ian McGilchrist, is a very left brain concept. Narrative is probably what I'd want to go with. But within the Gospels, they are communicating a system of theology, if you will. And I know I'm being very pedantic with my word choice.
No, but I love our conversations because I've never, ever considered that before. There's a lot that I'm learning here, even in just this one episode. So I'm thinking of, at many weddings, you've probably seen this, it's becoming, I don't know if it's common, but I've seen it multiple times, that people, a husband and a wife, will wash each other's feet during the ceremony. Have you seen this yourself?
I have not.
Have you heard of this even?
I think I might have heard of it.
Okay. So are you all in on this interpretation that this is about confession? And if so, does that make what happens at weddings just kind of silly? Because the idea is, I'm serving you. It's more of like, it's an act of service.
Yeah. So I also don't want to be reductionistic, meaning that I think that when I look at something like like the foot washing, and I'm arguing for a picture of confession there, I don't want to say that picture that I believe is there and is intentional crowds out all other interpretations. I don't believe that. You know, in other words, I think that, forget the Bible, take any great piece of literature, of which the Bible is that, and then on top of that, inspired by the Holy Spirit, you have layers of interpretation. So I interpret this passage this way, you interpret it that way. Those may be contradictory, and that's where the literary criticism aspect comes in, but they may be complementary. You know, they can be both. There's layers of a text. So I wouldn't want to preclude, in the case of the foot washing, something else. What is interesting, though, about the sacrament of matrimony in Catholicism is all the other sacraments are given to you by a priest or deacon or bishop. In matrimony, the spouses perform that sacrament for each other. They are the ministers of that sacrament, which is really, really interesting. It's not the priest. The priest is there, but he's not the one who is performing that sacrament.
And what does that mean?
I think it speaks to the uniqueness of matrimony and the relationship between them, and it speaks to God working through one spouse into the other as a delivery of grace.
Man.
All sorts of fun stuff.
Wow, great episode. I like these kind of conversations. So, Ben, thank you for talking it all out there.
Yeah, we can come back with more on the Last Supper.
Yeah, I just realized, I'm just looking at the time here. I said, let's do a quick episode on Transfiguration.
We're like 45
minutes.
We went
an hour.
Minutes. Oh, my goodness.
Hour episode on all sorts of things.
I told you.
Off the cuff. So, listeners, we didn't have any Bible references in front of us. So, if we mess anything up, don't judge us.
Yeah.
But for now, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBoto.
And we're the Sci-Fi Christians, signing off.
Goodbye.